That was Marefka Sketches, a piece inspired by the paintings of Michael Marefka, composed by Buck McDaniel and performed by Carrie Fry as part of her brand new solo album, Seagrass, Works for Solo Viola. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson, and whether you are new to the show or a longtime listener, thank you so much for joining us today. You can support Relevant Tones by becoming a subscriber on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you can help us continue to bring you interviews and music by some of the world's most creative musicians. For the price of just one coffee per month, you can support us at patreon.com/relevanttones. I'm very excited to talk about a new album by violist and composer Carrie Fry that was just released last month. Carrie and I got together to talk about Seagrass and took a deep dive into the music and composers featured on the album, as well as the science fiction writings of Arkady Martin and the violist's need for a bigger wardrobe. Hope you enjoy the show. I'm here with Carrie Fry to talk about her new album, Seagrass, Works for Solo Viola, that will be coming out next week on Gold Bolus Recordings. This is your first album, solo viola album. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, and I've been meaning to make one for years and years. Actually, I had a plan for an earlier album of works that I commissioned, and then it was like so long since I'd played any of those that I had like a whole new round of commissions. And I was like, okay, I should really finally make the album.
I've been happy to get the recording in advance to be able to live with it for a couple weeks now and take it different places, not just sit at home and listen to it. It's just been a lot of fun.
Are you like listening in a car? I know you guys don't have a subway out there, right?
We have the light rail, what's called the, the link.
So oh, okay.
I've taken it to the airport and listened to your album, which is a nice ride. I've been reading your liner notes, and you have at the beginning of your liner notes, this album is simply a collection of solos I like by people I like. Can you tell me about some of the connections you have with the composers on here?
Yeah, I mean, some of these are people that I've played with, like Adrienne, obviously, we're very close friends, and we play in Desdemona together. We've done like duo and solo tours together. So I know her really well, and we wrote these sister pieces for each other. And then Alec, I lived with for the first month of the pandemic. So we met in a class at school. We were in this class with Jay Eckert, kind of talking about like contemporary music performance practice. And from there, we started this improvisation series together that ended up being online during the pandemic. And so we were just like cooped up for like a month and improvising and kind of like working on a duo piece together every day. And then out of that, he ended up writing the solo piece for me that feels a lot like my voice. You know, it's like he just wrote this thing where I'm like, wow, this feels so good to play. It feels like exactly what I want to be playing. But with his unique, like, he's so good with the just intonation stuff and like has amazing ears. So like filtered through that sensibility, which was really good for me to stretch towards. And I'm always striving for greater accuracy. But I really love the way he uses harmony and like the form of it. It feels really organic. And then Maria was one of the first composers I worked with when I moved to New York, because she was at NYU at the time. So I ended up meeting a lot of people who are going to be important to me later, like Josh Henderson, who's dating my former roommate, close friend, Julia Henderson. Coincidental that their last names are the same. This probably I should not be rambling about. Anyway, through Maria, I met all these awesome people in New York. And we've like met up over the years. I've played her quartets through Kind of Kings with Desdemona. And I've played a new trio that she wrote for my trio Chartreuse last year that was commissioned by the Women Composers Festival of Hartford. So I feel like that collaboration keeps popping back up in my life. And I really love her music. And it's one of those things where like when you see someone learn and it, you know, how their style changes over 10 years, it's really fun to be like, okay, like I've known your music for a long time and I really feel comfortable in this world. And then similarly with Anthony, I had played his trio with both Chartreuse and Desdemona in different performance configurations and just really loved that piece. I love his string quartet and I knew he had this solo piece for violin. So I was like, hey, can I steal this for a recital? And he was like, of course. So let's see, who else? Emily met through Columbia Composers, and we played one of her pieces in a Wet Ink large ensemble reading. And then I had heard her viola quartet, and I thought, well, if you can write for four violas, you can definitely write for one viola. So, yeah, and she had a kind of cool vision to do something a little different with it. And I love the incorporation of whistling and how it's like these shapes that move around. So I just thought that was really fun. And Buck, we've played together a bunch, met him through Desdemona also. We were doing a piece for string quartet with saxophone to commemorate 9/11. And then we ended up working together a bunch. And we've done some organ and viola recitals. I played at his church, actually, gonna do that tomorrow. And this piece we originally played as like part of a suite of viola and organ music, including a piece by Nico Muhly and some more music by Buck. And then I was like, actually, this would be great to put on the album because it kind of draws together a lot of the things that I like about the other pieces, like arpeggiation, grooviness, noise, like grit, like a lot of those elements kind of come together in a little palate cleansing banger finish.
Yeah, definitely a banger finish. It may actually end up being the first track on this episode. And also, your piece, Seagrass Reed, is featured on here, as well as the opening track.
Yeah, I know myself very well. We've been working together a long time.
Yeah, I bet. I wanna ask about this piece because I'm really interested in, you said it was born out of your love for Arkady Martine's piece, A Memory Called Empire, and the sequel, A Desolation Called Peace. Can you
Yeah.
tell me a little bit about those books and Martine's work?
Yeah, I mean, she's awesome. I love these books because they have elements. It's kind of like what if the Aztec Empire was in space? So there's like all these elements of like poetry and flowers and just like, yeah, what it's like to be in an empire. You know, like there is something going around that's like everybody thinks about the Roman Empire all the time. A lot of science fiction is about the Roman Empire. This one is like about empire generally, but maybe a different empire. And I loved the naming conventions. That's where I got the name of the piece. It's like everybody has a name that is like a plant or an object, and then they have a nickname that's a shortened version of it. That's like, so it is like related to seagrass, but diminutive. So I use that to name the other versions of this piece, which are not like actually out of the book, but Seaglass Pebble, the quartet version, and then Starshine Gleam, the viola and saxophone version, which is going to be premiered in January. So yeah, there are just like a lot of fun poetic elements in the books. But I also love this idea of like empire clashing with like an alien empire, which I don't want to like give too many spoilers about, but like what happens when like great powers meet, which we're seeing a lot of now. And also like on a personal level, what it feels like to be like in something or out of something, and whether you can transform yourself to fit the expectations that society has for you, and like the ways in which, I mean, there are so many cool things in it about like proprioception, like the feeling of like experiencing someone else's body from the inside or like moving together. And that's such a huge part of chamber music for me. It's like when you're in a quartet, you're feeling your body move with other people's bodies and being like, that is my bow hand. Like, I'm gonna be that person's bow arm right now so that we can like change perfectly together and make this blended sound. So a lot of those ideas I thought were just like really inherently musical. And yeah, just the way she uses language is so evocative. Like I would see sentences and be like, I can hear that. So yeah, I would really recommend reading these books. They're super fun. She's like a scholar of Byzantine history and like a city planner and just like has all of these cool intellectual pursuits that all feed into her books.
I was happy to read up on her a little bit. That was fun. I'd never heard of her work, and read a little bit from Macmillan, has posted a couple chapters to read a little bit of her work. Yeah, extraordinary writing. I've never really read. You know, it's very much in the realm of science fiction, but it is very poetic, like you were saying too.
Yeah, and I think she thinks about form in the books is really apparent too. Like everything is kind of circular and like scenes will come back or settings will come back, which I think is an interesting way to like also bring that into a musical setting. Be like, how can I have things return?
Yeah, you're hitting on everything I want to ask about, which is awesome. So you talk a little bit in the liner note too about this idea of one consciousness in many bodies, many consciousnesses in one body. You related that to chamber playing. When I'm trying to visualize the score of this piece, because is talk to me a little bit maybe about what the score looks like and what interpreting it may look like for a performer.
Yeah, so I mean, One of my first like compositional activities was in college. I made a Christmas arrangement of Terry Riley's In C that's called Carrie Fraley's In Christmas. So I've always liked the idea of like having cells that you can play with, but in this one, the first page is pretty much like through composed, written out. And then the second page, the performer has like 12 different cells and they can use those in different orders, scramble them, elongate them, improvise on them. And I kind of give a few suggestions for how to interact with these cells. And then the third page is the like tappy, stretchy, dirty harmonic section with like the pressed multiphonics. And that one's really just like, here are some things that I want you to interact with and like stretch from this to this. So it's more just like, here's the sound and choose your own transitions. And then the next page is also kind of a set of cells and then a set of interrupting materials. So you can bounce between them, but I'll give like instructions about suggested order, but I'm always pretty open. And then the ending is also pretty much through composed, but you can add ornamentation and drop in like pizzicatos and kind of decide how many times to loop something. So it's a little open. I mean, I'm always kind of thinking about which music I've enjoyed playing the most. And I really like things like George Lewis's Artificial Life 2007, where it's like as much a way of like creating an algorithm for yourself about how to interact with other people and how to play. So I love that he like gives you suggestions of like how to think about what you're playing and not just like the material.
When thinking about cell compositional elements, in my experience of playing works that feature that, I have found that I personally like to go where the moment takes me into a particular cell. And but I have spoken with people too who like to kind of plan it out during performance. Do you ever have a preference when you're writing in that style of a path?
I mean, for myself, I think it's interesting because like I have two different recordings of Seagrass, and one of them is like 2 minutes longer, and then also Adrienne's version is like 2 or 3 minutes longer than mine. So I think it really depends on how you're feeling, which is one thing I like about this kind of flexible notation is that you can kind of be looking at your audience and be like, am I losing them? Should I play something loud now? Do I have them? I can do like something really long and quiet. So you can really respond to like how you're feeling and like what you're getting back in the moment. And also like when it's an ensemble piece, that gives you a lot of flexibility to be like, oh, they're doing this one, so I'm going to do another one now. So yeah, I guess I don't really have a preference. For sometimes for pieces, I'll like if there's a thing where it's like you have to use all of them in a certain amount of time, then I'll like sometimes make myself a path through. But generally, I like to just feel it out in the moment.
Let's listen to some music. This is Seagrass Reed, composed and performed by Carrie Fry.
You use so many different sounds from the viola, some that I've never heard before. Well, I'll point to some of the things that you talked about, some extended techniques. I'm very curious about preparing the viola. I want to ask about that. That is in Alec Goldfarb's piece, No Reading. Let's start maybe with that. Can you tell me a little bit about preparing the viola?
Yeah, so for Alec's piece, there's a circular paperclip, which you see a lot, and like Clara Yanata uses them, but it's a paperclip that it's kind of hard to find. You kind of have to buy them in Europe or order them. So I happen to have a couple left over from this piece that we'd done at Lucerne, and it, because of the circle, it hits several different harmonic nodes. So when you're putting on a string, you get like multiple harmonic resonances depending on where you are, and that makes it sound kind of like a percussion instrument or a gong because it has this metallic sound with kind of surprising notes inside it. And that I keep on for like the first three pages and then throw it on the ground.
A very specific paperclip you're talking about, though. It's not like not any paperclip will do.
Well, because American paperclips are tightly wound so that there are really just like two points of contact with the metal, but with the circular one, you have more space in between the bits of metal. Yeah, so it just works better. I have a hair clip that works in a similar way.
That's cool. I always find that interesting about preparations. I was lucky enough to do John Cage's prepared piano sonatas and interludes at one point, and it's very vague about some of the preparations that you use there. So I found myself having to really toy around with a lot of different types of bolt. Talk to me about some of the other sounds too that are a bit more unusual. That are there any that were brand new to you that composers were asking for, or most of these techniques were pretty familiar to you already?
I mean, in Emily's piece, I've never had to hum and play at the same time, so that was actually really difficult.
That sounds very difficult.
Humming is like a high resistance activity, so it takes more air, and then you have to like sustain a pitch for so long, but also be doing complicated things with your play. So yeah, that was a kind of new adventure for me. And then with Alex, it was really like the just intonation stuff where just I was trying to like learn to hear in a different way, and I feel like he's got such great ears for that. I'm still very much learning. So I'm like, if I played it again now, I think there are things where it would be even more accurate. But yeah, I just love the like getting used to different resonances and like learning what other pitches you're gonna get. It's like, yeah, I love teaching my students sixths because it's this thing where it's like, if you play these two notes, then you get a bonus third note for free. So with all this just intonation stuff, it's just like figuring out what your bonus notes are going to be and then listening for those. And I love doing that. So it's something I'm still like exploring further. I don't think you ever go far enough down that rabbit hole. Yeah, I guess those are kind of the new sounds for me. I mean, one that I write in Seagrass that I think not very many people use is the one where you're like playing a note on one string and then you're tapping another string that's resonating. So you're not actually like playing a new note or doing any kind of harmonic on the other string. You're just activating the resonance that's already there.
Let's take another listening break to hear more of the great music from this album. This next piece is Choros by Maria Kautsani.
Thank you.
I want to ask about some of the specific pieces. I want to ask about Maria's piece, Choros, which is I might be saying that one wrong, to Choros.
think it's probably like chorus.
It's the Greek word for dance, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and when she was writing it, she actually, I think the previous name was Strange Dance. So that's what it is.
It is, yeah, it is a strange dance. It's in a string of some more peppy pieces on the album, more upbeat and rhythmic pieces.
Upbeat, because to me, I guess it's upbeat because it's a dance, but it's also like kind of an aggressive feeling of like, you're gonna dance. Like, it kind of feels like once it starts, you can't stop. And yeah, I like how relentless it is and how kind of like it's like throwing caution to the wind, because there's all this stuff where like in order to make the chords work, you have to be really high up on a string and just kind of like jump there out of nowhere. So it kind of has that quality of like you're just like throwing yourself into the dance and you just have to like see what happens right then. Yeah, it really feels like you're spinning out of control.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's a better description than it's aggressive more than upbeat. I want to ask about two fits and starts too, because that one was it stood out to me as a quite a different piece from the collection. And I was like, oh, I'm excited to read the liner notes and read a bit about it. And I don't feel like I got too much further other than the liner notes are great. I hope it's okay. I'll read them really quickly. Sometimes change comes in fits and starts, two steps forward, one step back, cycles, patterns, moments of pause, and then perhaps is the liner note. And I think that's fantastic. Tell me a little bit about this piece. It comes right after Horos.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the interesting thing when I was sitting down with Emily, she was like, I don't want to write like one of those tragic viola pieces. There's kind of a trope with like composers writing a viola solo at the end of their life, and it's like, this is deathly music. So we were like, maybe something kind of peppy. So I feel like it's almost derpy at the beginning. It's just like, burr, 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 burr. It's like, ooh. And then it kind of gets refracted. Like to me, this one feels kind of like you're looking at the same thing through a kaleidoscope, or like it's the same pattern but a bunch of different ways. So it's never really regular. And every time you think you know it, you like look back at it and you're like, wait, that's not where I thought that would be. And then it starts to like morph and get like moved around. So you've got the same hand pattern, but you're like taking it up and down the viola. So I like that she like starts with a thing, but then immediately like is like, wait, and then breaks it a little bit. And then it goes off into this whole like dramatic thing. And then the end is like the beginning, but it's like bird chirps instead of like normal sounds. Yeah, so this one was a lot of fun. It's surprisingly difficult with all of the like vocal sustains and stuff, where I was like, actually, yeah, this is kind of complicated.
Thank you. talking about like this idea of expanding the viola repertoire, I think I had read somewhere that you mentioned it's a cliche. I hear a lot of violists say that too.
Yeah.
And avoiding the tropes of viola writing. And I do feel like there are moments in a lot of in many of these compositions on here that are willing to, I mean, the tropes, some of them are very lovely, right? And they get featured. There are elements of the contrapuntal writing for the viola is always just incredible. Can you tell me a little bit about just your idea of envisioning an expansion of the viola repertoire?
We're very picky people, so we have a bunch of pieces already, but it's like you're looking at your wardrobe and you're like, I have all these clothes, but there's nothing I want to wear. So you always need more pieces. You can't have enough pieces for the viola. And I was thinking about some of these, like, it's stuff that I would have loved to learn in college, like when you're like doing your Hindemith sonatas and your Brahms sonatas, and then you want like another flashy recital piece. So I'm hoping that some of these things are stuff that people can pick up and add to their solo repertoire. I mean, personally, when I'm looking for rep, I end up stealing from violin rep all the time. Like right now, I'm working on this Lawrence Dunn piece that I heard on Sarah Saviot's record. And I was like, wait, I listened to it 4 times and I was like, hold on, I love this because it never uses the E string. So he wrote it down. He's like, did you know you wrote a viola piece? So I'm stealing that. Hopefully for some performance soon, and then also some Westhoff suites, which are also for violin. So I'm always just like looking elsewhere for viola music, but I feel like we're kind of magpies. We're just like, ooh, pretty sounds, ooh, pretty sounds. And because we're in the middle, we're exposed to everything. So it's like you feel like you can have cello music, you can have violin music. And then when we want something that's like just for us, and then it's like, well, I don't want violinists to steal this. So I'm a little hypocritical about it, but yeah, I don't know. I just think it's this thing of like wanting everybody to have more options and more exposure to everything and just more abundance.
And many of these pieces, not all of them, you'll have to let me know which ones were arranged and went through a process of translating specifically to that instrument, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, just Anthony's piece was originally a violin piece, and then I literally just play it down a fifth. But he made a viola transcription of it, so it's new for viola. But it's really just the violin piece down a fifth. And my piece was originally for Adrienne, and then when I wrote it, I also kind of had in mind like there's not going to be that much E string, but I put in a few sparkles for her. There's some high stuff. So then when it's on the viola, I can just play the E string stuff on the A string high up and add a few like C string flourishes. But that one pretty much works for either the violin or viola.
Were any
Yeah.
of these done as ensemble works and orchestrated out to big group?
I mean, yeah, mine. Because I'm a recycler. So it's been, yeah, a violin and viola solos. It's been a trio. It's been a string quartet. I played it with my band, Arco Bello, led by Simon Baron. And I just finished the saxophone viola version. And they're all slightly different. Like, I'll add, there's an extra page in the violin viola one that's not in the quartet. And there's some material in the quartet that's not in the other ones. And then and the saxophone and viola when I kind of reworked a lot of things because saxophone is a very different instrument, it turns out. So that one is like almost a different piece, but
I think this album will hopefully be an awesome resource for composers who are writing for the viola. I remember when I studied composition in undergrad, and I would go to the viola professor and ask, what should I be listening to? And she said, Morton Feldman, and for the viola in my life, and listen to Carigliano's string quartet. And she had a few recommendations for what to check out. And Carigliano is still alive, but I don't recall too many living composers that she had for me to check out. And she's a new music performer, interpreter too.
I mean, when I was in high school, I was just listening to a ton of like Kim Kishkashian stuff because she's another person who's been doing so much commissioning and like worked with Kurtag and just has like an incredible repertoire of really interesting pieces.
So your album's coming out next week, and I understand that there's going to be an album release party, obviously, and a slash bowling party. Is that right?
Okay, that was the initial plan, and then I realized that everybody has like 15 shows a night in December. And actually, on the night I was going to go bowling, a friend of mine is playing a recital, and I was like, I would rather be hearing this recital than doing my album release party. So I'm going to do it in January, because I usually go bowling for my birthday anyway. So now I can kill two birds.
Where's the party?
Melody Lanes. I will be making more announcements about this at a later point, but I'm also looking to do like an actual album release show, where initially I was like, I don't know if I need to like play these pieces again right now, because I already toured with them with Adrienne, and I was like, if people want to listen, they can listen to the album. But I think it would be fun to do a performance. So I'm gonna do one in Brooklyn in January, and then one uptown at Kurokuren in Inwood on March 23rd. Yeah, March 23rd, because Emily Pretorius is involved with this coffee shop up in Inwood, so I'm playing at her coffee shop. Yeah.
Carrie, this is an awesome album. I've really enjoyed listening to it, just genuinely. Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm hoping people will tell me how it makes them feel, because I think that's the interesting part of putting music out there. And when you give it a performance, you get to hear about it right away. But when it's a recording, it's like, I don't know how this is like living. Like, I'm interested, you're listening to it on public transit, or like if people are listening to it in their cars, I'm like, I want to know what my music is doing out in the world.
I can say something that I appreciate. I like the individual pieces, and I also love your curation on the album. I mean, you thought about that, obviously. Can you tell me a little bit, maybe just about if you had an overall conception, or what are some things that you considered when you were curating it?
Yeah, I mean, I had some input from friends about like how the pieces flow together, but I was kind of thinking about energy levels, where at the beginning it's pieces that are a little more like amorphous and like textural, and kind of just like, my piece and Adrienne's are a little like, we're here and now, ooh, we're here. And then Alex's piece starts to have a little more groove and structure coming out of it. And then we get into like the more groove-based section of the album, where things are really like pushing forward. And then Buck's piece is a banger, so I wanted to like send people off with like, wow, that really sums it all up. I thought it had like a few ideas from earlier in the album, like it brings together the noise from mine and the arpeggiation that you hear in Adrienne's, and then like just wraps it up really nicely. So I was like, that's a perfect closer.
Yeah, it's nice to have an album that feels continuous. It really does.
Yeah, I've got to shout out my glorious engineer, Murat Cholik, who really like thought about also the scope of it, and like having each piece feel like it's in the same space, and just like making it feel like a whole thing.
That's all for our show today. A big thank you to Carrie Fry and to Gold Bolus Recordings for sending us an advanced copy of the album to check out and feature. Thanks so much to you, our listeners. We want to hear from you, your thoughts on the episode and the music, what you've been listening to lately. You can drop us a line at relevanttones.com. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson. Thanks for listening and be well.